This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The IFJ is firmly in support of Mumia and Assange to free them both.
It's not every day that an international organization sends a delegation to come to the U.S. to actually go into the prisons to call out somebody who's being railroaded by the U.S. government.
Members of the National Writers Union and the International Federation of Journalists call for the freedom of Julian Assange and Mumia Abu-Jamal.
They will blow up the entire entertainment industry for another quarter of record profits and do it with a smile. After all, they say, what are you going to do about it? Well, we told them exactly what we're going to do. We struck.
Thousands of workers and trade unionists rallied in Los Angeles to support the Striking Writers Guild of American West workers.
There was a clear human rights discourse, which is also a counter discourse because Malcolm is also a critique of human rights. So there's a clear attempt to institutionalize all of this, of which Malcolm literally was doing.
May 19th marked the 98th anniversary of Malcolm X's birthday. And May 25th was Africa Day, formerly known as African Liberation Day, celebrated throughout the African diaspora. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. For those of you who have been listening to COVID Race and Democracy, we have changed our name to Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We will continue to cover COVID, but we've reimagined ourselves as we have expanded our coverage over the 3 years we've been broadcasting. Now, on with the show. On World Freedom Day, the National Writers Union and International Federation of Journalists participated in an international meeting on the freedom of journalists at the United Nations. U.S. political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal had this message for his fellow journalist.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal to the IFJ. My fellow journalists and members of the International Federation of Journalists, I thank you for the work you do. I thank you for telling the stories of the people, of the oppressed and the repressed people all around the world. Your work has uncovered the excesses of the state as they dominate the people they claim to serve. Indeed, I write to you from one of the world's greatest sites of mass incarceration, the United States, generally, and in particular, the state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania held more juvenile lifers than any jurisdiction on the planet Earth. And while that ebbed after the Miller case became law by the U.S. Supreme Court, just last summer, in June 2021, the Jones versus Mississippi case came out, reversing Miller. So Miller is no more. America, the prison house of nations, still. Struggles for freedom are happening across America, yes, but it happens in the shadow of repression. America, born in violence, seeded in
this
violence.
This is a call from
Pennsylvania State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy.
This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Remains a nation wrapped in the coils of violence, until, as we all have recently seen, even the babies aren't safe in small towns of America. Your work is valuable, for it is freedom work. I thank you all. Merci pour tout le monde. I thank you for doing what you do every day, being the voice of the people who are voiceless. This is your brother, and comrade. In love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Pacifica Steve Seltzer spoke to Larry Goldbetter, president of the National Writers Union, and Edward Hasbrock, a delegate at the UN conference representing the National Writers Union and the International Federation of Journalists.
Larry, why don't you talk about your union's position and why you brought together both the case of Julian Assange and Mumia Abu-Jamal?
First, let me say that, you know, we're an affiliate union of the International Federation of Journalists, which represents 150 unions in about 140 countries and represents 600,000 journalists around the world. And at World Congress last year and at previous meetings, the IFJ is firmly in support of Mumia and Assange to free them both.
And Larry, you visited Mumia with a delegation of journalists?
Yes, a small group of us on March 9th, had a three-hour visit with Mumia, myself representing IFJ and NWU, Patrick Kamenka from the French National Union of Journalists, and blocking his name, Jackie Hartout of the French Collective for the Liberation of Mumia, Le Brand Mumia. And in France, you know, this has been quite a campaign. When Mumia was on death row, which was 30 years of the 40-something he's been in prison, there were weekly demonstrations in Paris to free him. And since he was taken out of death row, they've gone to monthly meetings, but it's still a very live issue.
It seems that there's a struggle in this country for people to understand the importance of the defense of journalists like Mumia, and also the case of Julian Assange, who is another journalist who's in security prison in Britain. They have really faced the wrath of the state for exposing, in the case of Mumia, the crimes of Philadelphia police, and in the case of Julian Assange, the crimes of the U.S. government in Iraq.
Exactly.
And it seems like this is a danger, a growing danger for not just them, but for all journalists, as far as this, the use of laws like the espionage law against somebody who's not even a citizen of the United States. Edward?
Yeah, this was a theme that we heard on World Press Freedom Day, where I was in New York in the UN General Assembly chambers at an all-day symposium that was held with speakers from around the world, from a variety of organizations, non-governmental organizations, journalism organizations, human rights defenders.
Here's the excerpt from the United Nations Assembly event on World Press Freedom Day, with Edward Hasbrock representing the National Writers Union and International Federation of Journalists.
We have time for one question. The gentleman on the left is the one I saw first.
I represent the International Federation of Journalists and the National Writers Union, one of its affiliates here in the United States. And since we're naming names, I want to call the attention of this body to Julian Assange, who the U.S. is attempting to criminalize for publishing truthful information about U.S. war crimes, and the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a journalist and member of our organization who has been in prison for decades in the United States. And my question is, since you are speaking of accountability, while it's easy to speak of accountability for individual actors or to criticize small states in the global South, what are the means of accountability that can hold accountable the governments of a great power such as the United States and the global North when its government attempts to criminalize journalism?
Back to the discussion.
What is happening with Assange and Mumia and the kinds of charges that are being brought against them are very much mirroring a global pattern, despite the fact that the U.S. wants to present itself, of course, as being better than the rest of the world on human rights. And, you know, we all know that that isn't true and need to punch through that wherever we get a chance.
And the number of journalists that have been imprisoned, been targeted, tortured, murdered is growing. The war in Iraq, I remember the United States military blew up a news agency on a building, and they said they didn't know that it was a location of journalists.
And in in Ukraine, you know, the journalists have been targeted. In Palestine, the Israelis have targeted media centers and journalists. And of course, the murder of Shireen Abu Akleh, and one of many.
Isn't it illegal under international law to target journalists and murder journalists?
Well, actually, one of the calls, you know, we were distributing at the UN the statement produced for World Press Freedom Day by the International Federation of Journalists, and its central call is that there needs to be a new international instrument, a new treaty specifically to protect journalists and to mandate that governments investigate and prosecute those who attack journalists. So, yes, broadly speaking, attacks on journalists are going to be attacks that violate existing human rights law, existing principles. But there is a need for greater clarity, and that's a central call of the International Federation of Journalists to beef up the international legal regime. Part of the problem is that more and more journalism is being outsourced to stringers and freelancers rather than to staff writers. The NWU represents freelancers primarily, in contrast to Newspaper Guild and SAG-AFTRA, which represent more the staff writers in print and broadcast journalism, respectively. But it's one thing if you're a staff writer and you are targeted. We heard at World Press Freedom Day, again, in New York, about the situation of Evan Gershkowitz, the New York Times reporter who's been accused of espionage in Russia. But in his case, we had, you know, Arthur Sulzberger, publisher of the New York Times, being given the podium at the UN to talk about all the things that the New York Times is doing to try and help out their staff employee, which is all great, except that more and more, even war reporting is being outsourced. And if you're a stringer, you're a freelancer, you don't have the army of lawyers and support and the publicity machine of the New York Times or an organization like that backing you up.
Well, Julian Assange was a member of the Journalist Union in Australia, which has taken up his case and supported him, the International Federation of Journalists. And Mumia Abu-Jamal was a member of the CWA NABIT at public radio in Philadelphia. Yet it seems like News Guild and also the AFL-CIO don't take up the issue and haven't taken up the issue.
No, I mean, I think, you know, we're here on behalf of the National Writers Union, on behalf of the International Federation of Journalists. I don't think there is any organization that represents the collective voice of journalists worldwide better than IFJ, and they've been clear and unambiguous for years. I mean, it's not every day that an international organization sends a delegation to come to the U.S. to actually go into the prisons to call out somebody who's being railroaded by the U.S. government.
About a year ago, I guess, by now, the Times and Le Monde and Spiegel and
Washington Post,
El País, they put out a joint statement about Assange, calling for his release and for the government to drop the charges. The unions have not responded like that. And on our part, we've been trying to organize that kind of a response to get the major journalist unions in the U.S. to sign a joint letter to the Biden administration, to the Department of Justice, saying drop the charges. We think that would really go a long way. And even if it didn't help that much legally in the legal case, it would help tremendously in terms of U.S. unions taking a stand about somebody who exposed U.S. war crimes, where every journalist union in the world has taken this position except the U.S. You know, I think it's kind of a universal trend right now about attacking the media. And it's not just the major powers that are, you know, shaping imperialist war. And it's like a universal trend to, as the world gets closer and closer to war, to they say the first casualty of war is the truth, and journalists are embodying that saying right now.
Those were members of the National Writers Union and the International Federation of Journalists speaking with Pacifica Steve Zelter. That was the Robert Glasper Experiment, Gonna Be All Right. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. Thousands of workers and trade unionists rallied in Los Angeles to support the Striking Writers Guilds of America West, who have been on strike for nearly a month. Other workers in the industry, including the Screen Actors Guild and Directors Guild, are voting on whether or not to strike. At the rally, the SEIU announced that Los Angeles city workers had taken a vote and may be joining the strike. Speakers at the rally included the president of the Writers Guild of America West, Meredith Steen. KPFK's Working Voices correspondent Peter Rasipo also interviewed writers on the line about the attack on their conditions by the billionaire tech companies.
The president of the Writers Guild of America West. We have lots of members here today. Look for the blue shirts. Hey, writers. We are here because we are union, just like everyone else here, and we are on strike. This is day 24. We've been on the picket lines fighting for a fair contract. But we have not walked alone. We've seen you out on the line, SAG-AFTRA. We've seen you, IATSE. AFM. We've seen you, Teamsters. Trucks are pulling up to our picket lines, and they are turning around, and they are shutting down production. Within our unions and among our unions, and we have that. We feel that. And that's because something is happening out there, something new. Labor is rising. We have your support, because other unions, other workers see their struggle in our struggle. You're also feeling marginalized, gigged out. Pressed for as much work as possible, for as little pay as possible, and it's not right. It's not humane. It's not moral. The bosses, management, corporations, they must share the wealth that we helped create. They must share it properly and fairly, and until they do, we will hold the line. Now, I don't think the studio saw this blue wave coming, writers. I think they misjudged our power, the backup we have from Hollywood labor and LA labor. And by the way, when it's your turn, we will be there with you. The bosses knew what they were up against when they failed to listen to us 24 days ago. But they should look around. They should look at this crowd and this unity, and if they didn't know, well, now they know. Union now, union forever, let's go.
Hi, my name is Frankie Butler, and I am a proud member of the WGA. I am only able to write for a living because of the WGA. See, I wanted to be a writer my whole life, but it wasn't until I learned there was a union that would guarantee me a fair wage, health insurance, a frickin' pension, that I realized I could make a career out of this. And I have. I started as support staff. I worked my way through the ranks. I have spent the last 7 years working with amazing people, making a living out of this. And I have spent every day of those last 7 years watching making a living get harder. I've taken pay cuts just to be able to keep working. I have driven myself crazy doing a month's work in a week or two just because the studios wouldn't pay for more of my time. I have watched people who started when I started
bust their asses, only to watch the ladder to a reasonable career burst into flames the second they reach the first rung. And it is the companies that are setting that ladder on fire. It is the companies that are saying to us, just as they've said to so many other workers, that they refuse to invest in us, that they don't value our skills. They don't care about training. They'll just have us do more work with fewer people for less money while they roll around in the profits we make for them. They will blow up the entire entertainment industry for another quarter of record profits and do it with a smile. After all, they say, what are you gonna do about it? Well, we told them exactly what we're going to do. We struck.
My name is Emma Soren. I am a proud WGA member and captain. I joined the Guild last year as a staff writer on a TV show called Koala Man. And so I'm here striking because my guild is on strike. But a lot of the issues that we're fighting for on the negotiating table affect me personally and all of my friends. A large one is minimum room sizes and requiring to have an actual TV staff because the studios are constantly just trying to squeeze money out of everything and have like one or three writers write a whole episode or a whole season of television when the norm for years and years has been to have like 10 to 15 writers write that. And that's what makes good TV, collaboration. But because these tech companies have come in and disrupted the industry, now they're always trying to save money. And why break something that,
why fix something if it's not broken or something like
right,
that?
Right, why fix something if it's not broken? This is David, our law coordinator.
You're doing an interview, that's fine.
No, what's up? It's okay.
Oh, I just want to say hi.
If you want
to you're welcome to also too, contribute, you know, what your experiences have been. Yeah.
It's for radio, potentially.
Oh, okay. I appreciate everything you did today. It was
Thank
a good
you.
Day, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And I was telling Noah, I trust you guys, so I don't, you know, we're a good team.
Yeah,
so.
We
got it down. There's not a lot of, I saw the text, but we had the music going over there.
Yeah,
I didn't
want
to pull people that were having a great time. So.
No,
yes,
okay.
What do you want me to ask? You're a great tambourine player.
Oh, thank you.
Weren't you doing drums too for a while?
I was.
Okay.
Well, I just wanted to ask, you know, what have been your experiences as writers? And you know, she was describing how big tech has come in and really shaken up how writers are, you know, what their working conditions are like. You know, decreasing the number of workers that are working on projects. Could you maybe describe how that process has played out, how the tech companies have intervened in that way?
Well, what they do is there were, you know, in the era of streaming, they were smaller orders of shows by the meaning the number of episodes. So, for instance, when I first started in television 28 years ago, 26 episode seasons.
Unheard of now.
Yeah, and then I did a show called Battlestar Galactica. We had 22 episode seasons. And that was the beginning of this starting to make the season smaller and smaller because they started breaking it into season 2, part 1. And now we'll take a 6-week or 2-month break and then season 2, part 2. And but as the streaming era has come, the orders have gotten smaller and smaller. But because they want to make a splash with these series, they stretch the production calendar out, and we get paid by the episode. So they go, we're going to amortize, so you get a fee per episode. And you might think, wow, I got a great raise. And we're going to stretch that out over 9 months. And the first 3 months, you're going to work for guild minimum, which is not that much money. So what it's done is it's driven our income down, you know, and you even if you're upper level, which I am, you struggle to make your year, to make it through your year. So that's one thing. And the other thing, the streaming era that's super important is, you know, writers, I wrote 2 books, and novelists, authors, they own the copyright to their material for the rest of their lives. So you continue to have income from that thing that you created because you have the copyright for the rest of your life. We give up our copyright in television. we hand it over to the studios, even though we created it. But in exchange for residuals, which has always been the understanding, okay, well, that's how we participate in the profits. That's our royalty, so to speak. Well, in the streaming era, they've said, well, we're not really making that much money off streaming. And when I started it 28 years ago in syndication, you could, a series could end and you could, through your residuals, make it through a year. Because you still have good income stream. That's not possible anymore. The money is so small and it's so out of proportion with what they're making off these shows. It's an injustice.
Right. So, and also there's more work, I imagine, per person, right?
Or you do a lot more work, yes. Yeah. Right. I'm what's called a number two, so not only the showrunner has to do more work, but then we are expected to do a lot of work. And again, stretched out, and your pay is not that grandiose. So, and it's moving, continues to move in that direction. What they'd like to do is make us all 1099 employees, not pay us health care, not pay for health care, not give us any pension, you know, so our future's not secure. Take us back to where it was in the 1950s with television writers, sold scripts, I happen to know because I wrote a book about this, sold a script for $900. That's it. There's your $900. You know, no pension, no, you know. Clyde Bruckman, co-director of Buster Keaton's The General, biggest gag writer of the 1920s, when he fell out of fashion and ended up having to write Three Stooges comedies for very little money, and then couldn't get that work, went into a bar in Santa Monica, ordered a drink, went in the bathroom, blew his brains out. The guy who co-directed The General, because there was no pension, he was destitute. That was the lot of many writers once upon a time. And it will be again if we don't win this battle.
And writers have expressed a lot of concern about new generative AI that's coming out. What are your thoughts on how that's affecting writers and what needs to be done in order to counter that?
Well, what Chris Kaiser, our chair of our negotiating committee or co-chairs, has said is they want to move into a place where there'll be a showrunner and maybe one other writer, and then AI does all the work that the writing staff used to do. So they want to have a HAL 9000 write your television for you. You want to watch those shows? Does that sound exciting to you?
No, not to me.
Yeah, right. It sounds exciting to them up there.
Right.
Because they can keep more money for themselves. So they can be on their super yachts in the Caribbean giving notes on scripts.
Right. So they want massive layoffs and downsizing.
Of course. That's what they always want. That's what Wall Street always wants. And Wall Street controls all these companies. They have from the beginning of the movie industry. That's what Wall Street pressures for.
Right.
Yeah. The less writers they employ, the less power the writers have as a collective unit. And that's what we're out here every day striking for. And we're showing our collective power.
Well, are there any other... any lessons of the strike or any thoughts that you'd like to leave people with about how to win this fight?
Tenacity. Don't give up. Stay strong. Stay united. Don't let them divide you. Don't let them instill fear in your ranks, which they work every day to do. And we will win. We're going to win. That was through the 2007 strike. I have no doubt we're going to win.
Yeah. I think the way the studios have already stretched out these production cycles and seasons has taught us to be used to going without work for 8 months at a time. So we're ready for a strike. We're used to this. We don't want it to be the future, but they've created a condition where we're ready to strike. Yeah.
We will stay out here until we get what we deserve.
Those were workers on the picket line and speakers at the Mass LA Solidarity Rally, speaking with KPFK Working Voices correspondent Peter Rasipo on May 26, 2023.
From dawn till dusk, I'm getting no money, I'm getting nowhere. The diamonds, the gold, they filter through my hand, just like the cougar on the coin of death. My soul's in a state of emergency.
Emergency.
Hey, my
emergency.
Soul is in a state of emergency.
Emergency.
Yeah.
Emergency.
My singing with yesterday's coffin on their heads. My soul's in a state of emergency. Yeah. I tell you, my soul is in a state of emergency. Is gone, everybody is your enemy. Apartheid's in a state of emergency. Yeah, I tell you, it's in a state of emergency. Yeah, my soul is in a state of emergency.
Sweet Honey and the Rock. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Aku Holt. Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney, co-producers and co-hosts of Extinction Rebellion Radio, reflect on Atlanta's Cop City and the death of an activist there and discuss police militarization nationally.
A recent article in The Guardian reports that 1 in 20 gun homicides in the U.S. are committed by police. That figure comes from Mapping Police Violence, a nonprofit database of police killings. Mapping Police Violence found that police officers killed at least 1,192 people in the United States in 2022. The numbers are likely higher, however, because information about police killings is notoriously hard to come by. And we want to focus today on a specific police killing that happened in January, and that's the killing of Manuel Turan.
Yeah, Manuel Turan was killed in a law enforcement raid on a forest encampment of activists protesting Cop City. That's what the protesters call it. And that Cop City is a police training facility under construction on an 85-acre piece of South River Forest, which is a wooded area southeast of Atlanta, Georgia. Cop City is a $90 million monstrosity. Imagine using that money to address the unhoused situation in Atlanta, or even just to fund schools, right? Now, its purpose, according to The Intercept, is to, quote, train cops in militarized urban warfare, end quote. Train cops in militarized urban warfare. I know that happens, but it just continues to boggle my mind that we continue to militarize the police.
Urban warfare. That's the wording that they, that's not our wording.
So they have these structures, they have these planned structures where they're actually simulated homes and apartments or whatever, so that people, so that the cops get conducting warfare in the cities, or they're simulated cities. I'm sorry. It just bugs me to no end. The Atlanta Police Department intends, quote, to recruit 43% of the planned facilities trainees from out-of-state police departments. They're going to spread them all over the country like COVID. Numerous multinational corporations, including Coca-Cola and Bank of America, are funding project. So we also know that Bank of America in particular is behind a lot of fossil fuel funding madness. And the intersection of these kind of corporations with fossil fuels and state police departments is well documented. I bring this up because it's also an environmental issue. So police, environment, fossil fuel industries, and, you know, corporations, they all go together. Anyway, framing the protesters as terrorists, DeKalb County Police, the Georgia State Patrol, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, and the FBI violently raided the encampment, arrested 23 activists, and in that raid killed Manuel. The arrestees were charged under state domestic terrorism laws. But they didn't just kill Manuel, right? They shot him 23 times. That's attempted spirit murder. And that term spirit murder I'm getting from Patricia Williams, the law professor, who used it to characterize killing the body with just more than one shot, but like several shots. Like he's not dead enough, right? Now, I say attempted spirit murder because, you know, these law enforcement folks cannot kill what he stood up for, what Manuel stood up for, which is Earth, and which is justice, which is the resistance, which is the people's intention to make real the good life for all of us. People in Atlanta and around the country have not stopped protesting. They're protesting even more because of this ridiculous cop city and the violence of it. But the police will certainly continue to try to kill our spirits and our movement when they kill our bodies. Now, the police claim that Manuel shot and injured a state trooper with a handgun first. No such thing was captured on an officer's body camera. In fact, what you do hear on body camera audio of this horrific raid is an unnamed police officer reacting to the gunfire, which suggests the officers might have been shooting at each other. This officer said, quote, "Man, you f***ed your own officer up," end quote. In other words, a cop shot the state trooper who Manuel was accused of shooting. It seems to me that police are at war with us. A 1 in 20 killings is a lot. And the question is, why are they at war with us and for whose benefit?
In a way, a restatement of that question, but who is guilty of domestic terrorism here? The activists who are trying to protect Earth and climate and justice, who have been charged, as you said, at least under domestic terrorism laws, or is it the people who are committing violence against those activists, the people who are shooting Manuel, the people who are planning urban warfare? They're planning it. It's premeditated domestic terrorism by police departments.
Yeah. And Cop City makes loud and clear the intersectional violence of the settler state, that intersectional violence of environment, this environmental violence, racial violence, class violence. You know, in the Red Deal, the Red Nation writes that, quote, "water protectors and land defenders are the new generation of political prisoners," end quote, and that the, quote, "intense criminalization of caretaking reveals the extent to which the ruling class will go to protect its interests and keep capitalism in place," end quote. One has to think about what we are resisting and what kinds of changes we're asking for in order to protect our Earth and our brothers and sisters everywhere, human and non-human alike. One has to think about what we're asking and the kind of resistance we're getting and what kind of threat our asks is to those in power. And so it should be no surprise that they are coming up with cop cities. We'll see more of those popping up, I'm sure.
We just heard from Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney, co-producers and co-hosts of Extinction Rebellion Radio. Music by the great late Archie Shepp and Khalil El-Zabar's Ritual Trio, Brother Malcolm. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Aku Holt. On May 25th, Africa Day, formerly known as African Freedom Day and African Liberation Day, an annual commemoration of the foundation of the Organization of African Unity, the OAU, formed on May 25, 1963 in Ethiopia, was celebrated worldwide. The OAU transformed to the African Union on July 9, 2002 in Durban, South Africa. Additionally, May 19th marked the 98th birthday of El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X. Mwiza Muntali of WPFW's Africa Now produced a panel discussion featuring a number of scholars, including co-host Dr. James Pope and others, to examine the legacy of Malcolm X, the Black radical tradition, and Africana human rights movements.
El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz is us. He is the measuring scale upon which we deal with the balanced, unbalanced dialectic. He is the archetype, the most articulate expression of a Black radical imagination, the most articulate expression of Black possibilities. What you will hear next is a recent discussion centered around an exploration of El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz as critical Africana human rights consciousness with Tasneem Siddiqui, Josh Myers, and comments from Dr. Kamal Rashid and Dr. Iyele Ichile. Oh, you'll hear a few thoughts from me as well. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corbis and Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, and Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think deeply, act accordingly.
So, you know, we're talking about El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz and how we remember, and really how we remember our ancestors and our guides, our teachers, the great ones who exemplifies what it means to be fully human, how they've expanded our radical imaginations and visions. And in this most sacred month of Ramadan, and so I have a very, you know, personal and political and intimate relationship and spiritual relationship to Malcolm X, which is a lunar celestial event, remembering Malcolm, who himself was a Muslim, who observed and restored spiritual balance and alignment during this blessed month and receiving clarity and power. And which Ramadan follows this lunar calendar, so it moves back every year, every 10 days. And so this month, Ramadan coincides with the month of his birth. And so that was very significant for me. So remembering his life, his practice, his praxis, his radical dreaming and visions is a medicine story. His story is a medicine to our culture. He innovatively revived our teachings, our ancient teachings, for now moments and future moments. And he helps all of us, our children, and those yet to come with and with us ever still, to find our own medicines, our own gifts and abilities towards a corrective praxis, radical social transformation, and meaningful, dignified, expansive existence. I want to remind everyone this is a public conversation. So this is as much a cipher as it is a medicine story, as it is a rhythmic vibrations and improvisation. So tonight we sit together with storytellers and wise ones to remember El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz as an exemplar of our Black radical tradition. And I really want us to think, you know, about questions, conversations that we want to explore as we think about this. So let me introduce some of our wise ones and our storytellers tonight who are sharing space with us. And there's so many that are on the call as well too. So I'm definitely going to give a shout out to folks, and I would really love for them to take part of this conversation. So to introduce James Pope, who is here, there, and thinking a little bit about the future and what it is. And I'm so grateful and blessed to introduce Dr. Josh Myers. And Josh Myers is an associate professor of Africana Studies in the Department of Afro-American Studies at Howard University. He is the author of We Are Worth Fighting For, a history of the Howard University student protest of 1989. It was published by New York University Press in 2019. 2019, and Cedric Robinson, The Time of the Black Radical Tradition, which was published in 2021, as well as the editor of A Gathering Together, a literary journal. So just to kind of frame some of our conversation tonight, we're really in conversation with James Pope's most recent article, Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, The Continuity and Legacy of a Critical Africana Human Rights Consciousness. And he situates Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz's practice, as well as the Africana Black movements for freedom, and to human rights discourse. Our conversation between James Pope and Josh Myers will draw from this critical exploration of Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz's evolution into an internationalist activist theoretician in five rhythmic movements. As Pope beautifully articulates, the opening, the transitioning, the solidification, the influencing, and the continuities. It is the central premise of their work and this panel that in order to fully grasp the breadth and depth of the Africana Black struggle for freedom, we must explore those involved in their contributions as a product of a critical human rights consciousness. Accordingly, Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz becomes an archetype in this regard. This idea rests upon the assertion that his praxis, albeit complete due to his untimely assassination, represents an important nexus in the Africana struggle for freedom, merging various manifestations of radical praxis into a clearer articulation of the Black radical tradition. So I want to open up our conversation, really, if James can kind of think about with us these rhythmic movements of Elhaj Malik's life, and you liken them to Black classical music, to jazz, a way of hearing, seeing, experiencing, knowing, and transcending the world. And so I guess my first question for you is why Malcolm for this theoretical concept? What are some of those influences, the spiritual, geographic, material, physical influences?
Well, thank you. So to begin, I think rhythmically. And so I think that that is probably something that is inculcated in the ancestral and historical memory of us as being Africana people, is that we generally think multiple ways and multiple forms simultaneously. So when I was thinking about this, is that there was a couple of influences that prompted me to really situate Malcolm. Number one is that I'm trying to dive into an ocean of conversation, particularly critiquing this notion, the theory and practice of human rights, as being fundamentally flawed, but yet has ultimate potential when you look at the Africana experiences of people around the world, right? So we have a very, very complex way of understanding the human, of understanding actually different ways, the different forms of how we relate as human beings. So when I was thinking about this broader project that I started way back in about 2000, a while ago, is that as I was also moving through my own activism, coming out of and having contact with folk who had been organizing, coming into contact with folk and having personal relationships with people who have been organizing for a long particular time, one of the questions I always had is, what happens to our movement? How do we move, or how do we understand our resistance, and what should we carry forward? And all of these things are really, really popping at me. I'm engaging in reading Malcolm. I'm engaging in listening to Malcolm. I'm engaging to talking to people who knew Malcolm. I'm engaging, in all of these areas. And so for me, it was a lot. So what I tried to do is develop a framework for us to really understand this broader category of the Black radical tradition, the questions that Cedric Robinson lays out. How does race influence us on a deeper level, such as Dr. Audrey Smetley is laying out with Cedric Robinson and other particular folk, and Sylvia Winter, how we're thinking about this? And it's a lot. And so what I tried to do is provide a framework for us to really understand, what are we resisting for? What is our ultimate goal? And so as I started to read this, and of course, Malcolm is very clear about human rights, which I will get to, because now I'm thinking about how would he situate his idea of human rights in the context of today, given that human rights itself, been theory and practice, is flawed. It is influenced by race at a philosophical and theoretical level, but necessarily, which also impacts its practical level. Mm-hmm. So what I developed was this critical, what I call a critical Africana human rights consciousness, because this is what I really articulated Africana freedom movements attempting to do. All of its manifestations was attempting to move us closer to a more nuanced and more deeper understanding of what it means to be human, juxtaposed to these conversations out of Europe with it, of rights and all of these particular things. So that is the concept. And Malcolm was best articulate. He was the one who was able to articulate this theoretical framework in a material form. And just to give, you know, folk just a little snapshot of what that framework is there's developed or looked at five particular components right now, and I'm sure there'll be others as I start to think about this a little bit more, is that when we're thinking about folk and particularly Africana freedom movements moving resistance towards a more advanced human rights perspective, is that there was internationalists, there was a counter discourse, there was ideological attempt to develop an ideological propensity or ideology is being used to move towards freedom or trying to develop an ideology. There was a clear human rights discourse, which is also a counter discourse because Malcolm is also a critique of human rights. So there's a clear attempt to institutionalize all of this, of which Malcolm literally was doing. And so when I was looking at the Africana freedom movements and trying to develop a way of how do we study forms of resistance, but how do we have a frame that we can pull from these particular Black radical traditions, I should say, and what is informing them, what can we pull to move forward across time and space? So that's a air view of that. And again, I really want to talk about, not to take control of the conversation, Malcolm is being a critique of human rights theory and practice as well, too.
And that's Dr. James Pope, who is the associate professor and program coordinator of Africana Studies at Winston-Salem State University. And of course, you know him as the executive producer and co-host of Africa Now. And also with him is Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, assistant professor. This is the legacy and continuity of a critical Africana human rights consciousness of El Hajj Malik El Shabazz.
That was Nwizi Muthali, host of WPFW's Africa Now and co-host Dr. James Pope. This was an excerpt of a panel discussion on Malcolm's legacy and impact on the Black radical tradition. You can listen to the entire program on WPFW Archives. We thank Fahima Sek for co-producing this segment. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced in part by Akua Holt and the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at Pacifica CRD and on Facebook at Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. You can't separate peace from freedom because no one can be at peace unless he has freedom. Malcolm X, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz.